So this is the last talk of the meditation retreat on a Sunday morning, and I wanted to just say a few little more words about meditation. It's a bit of a summary of what you've been doing so far, and also just a way of giving some directions for the future, what happens after you leave here. One of the things which I haven't actually mentioned in the formal talks, which is something which I should have, one of the important attitudes to the different techniques which you've learnt in this meditation course. This is a teaching which I've given to a few people during the interview periods, where you develop what we call skillful means, little attitudes, little ways of looking at the meditation object and developing it during this retreat. You develop these yourselves, and some of these you've got from myself. But when you ever use one of these techniques, you have to be very careful not to overuse them. I was saying during the interviews that sometimes that people develop one particular way, whether it's staying in the present moment, or whether it's focusing just on letting be, or whether it's doing a mantra or whatever. And you'll always find that these special tools which you develop, when you first develop them, you first use them, they're very powerful. And you think, wow, at last I've solved the problem, at last I can have an easy route into meditation. But then the meditator keeps on using that for a few times, and then it doesn't work as well, and then it doesn't work at all. And it's as if, like, you have a tool and you overuse it until it becomes so dull that it's hopeless and it's useless, and you have to throw it away. With these meditation techniques which you develop, these skillful means which you learn, always use them until such time as you realize they're not sharp, and then put them aside, and then pick up another skillful means and use that until it's not sharp, put it aside, and then pick up another skillful means. If you have a group of these skillful means, 5 or 6 or 7, which you have developed in your meditation practice, then when you've got to the 6th one and you've used it and it's not sharp anymore, and you go back to the first one, you'll find it's become sharp again, that it's powerful and it does the job. It's very similar, and it's a simile I gave in the interviews, to like the kangaroos in our monastery. Whenever they graze an area of grass, they never overgraze it, because if they overgraze it, they'll not just take the sweet tips of grass, but they'll take the less tasty middle pieces of grass and the quite sort of bitter bottom pieces of grass and the roots as well, and all the grass will die. However, by just taking the sweet bits at the top and then going off to some other grass and then coming back to that original piece another 7 or 8 days later, the grass has grown by then and they can take the sweet bits again and it never dies. In this way, that you should always take the sweet bits from your meditation techniques, and it really works very well. And when it starts to get sort of not as sharp, not as tasty, then move on and graze another meditation skillful means. I don't really always mean a different technique, because you can still be watching the breath, but watching it from different angles. Sometimes using a mantra with the breath, sometimes doing counting, sometimes just doing letting be, sometimes just being in the present moment with the breath. Whatever it is a skillful means which you use and you develop. Never overgraze it. And one of the purposes of having a retreat like this is like increasing your repertoire of skillful means. Because I've given many teachings here and giving you the benefits of some of the skillful means which I've developed over my years as a monk and as a meditator. And some of those you'll take on board and you'll further develop for yourself. And others which you'll find for yourself. For example, I did give the example of Ajahn Gunha, who just, when he meditates, he just does nothing. That was his very powerful skillful means. Which you can try that in your meditation. And sometimes, well, the first time you use it, you'll probably be very powerful. But then if you use it too much, then it becomes dull again. And the other skillful means which he used to use was when he breathed in as deliciously, as delectably as he possibly could. He tried to enjoy the in-breath as much as if you were tasting a delicious morsel of food and you want to get every ounce of taste out of this. And so you breathe in as beautifully, almost sensually as you can. And you breathe out just as deliciously as you can. You do that for a little while. And then you find you're developing the beautiful breath in that way. So instead of waiting for the breath to become beautiful, you actually make it beautiful. And that's a very powerful skillful means, because this is encouraging what certainly in my experience is perhaps the most powerful of skillful means in meditation, the perception of joy. Learning how to enjoy the meditation, learning how to look for joy in meditation, and learning how to develop the joy in meditation. Ever more beautiful states of mind. And I'm not quite sure if you noticed me while I was meditating, that sometimes if the mind became a bit hard, one of the skillful means which I used was just as my eyes were closed, I would just put a little bit of attention around my mouth and just force a smile. And you may have actually seen me if you happened to be looking at me at the time, just the face change into a small smile during the meditation. And that was done deliberately. And the reason I did it, because every time I do that and just put attention on my mouth and just smile, straight away what I'm watching brightens up. It becomes more enjoyable. There is that psychological link there between smiling and happiness. You can wait till you're happy before you smile, or you can smile first and be happy afterwards. So either way works. And so that's the skillful means which I use, just to smile a little in the meditation if the mind feels a bit hard. And it softens up, becomes bright, and I can proceed much quicker afterwards. So these are skillful means. Now, one of the other things which I've taught in this meditation, taught in words and also taught in practice, so I've led you to experience this, is just the way that the mind, gets programmed, the way that the mind learns, and the way that the mind remembers these skillful means and these teachings. You don't really need to write everything down on a piece of paper. You don't need to force yourself to remember these things. If you listen with mindfulness, with clear attention, you find that these things go in to the mind somewhere, and when it's the right time, the mind will remember them. The skillful means will be at your disposal when the time is right to use them. And it becomes fascinating actually to see this process of the mind being trained. That you may be a few days from here working or travelling around, and suddenly that something which I've said or something which you've experienced, a little piece of Dharma will pop up into the mind, and it will be quite pertinent to the experience you're undergoing, and it will tend to solve the problem and make your life easier. And you didn't call up that experience, at least not intentionally, not through your willpower. That little piece of Dharma came by itself. This is the way the mind works. You put all these little seeds in there. When it's the right time, those seeds will blossom forth into a flower, into a little insight, which will really help you in your daily life, and also help you in your meditation. So I don't mind teaching at length during these retreats. And sometimes when I do teach at length, people say, well, how can you assimilate all of that, all of those teachings? But how can you remember it all? You don't need to worry about assimilating or remembering it all, because you will. You'll all go in there somewhere, and it'll come out at the right time, where it's going to be very useful for you. And this is why, actually, there is a common experience when people do retreats such as this. They do 9 days or so of meditation. And then they think, well, they've done so much and they've got so far and it's all been very enjoyable and very interesting. But sometimes the best is yet to come when you leave this retreat. It happens again and again that maybe a couple of days, maybe a week, even 10 days after the retreat is finished, unexpectedly, wherever you may be in the car or in the office or even on the toilet, that the mind opens up, becomes bright, and you get nice insights, very deep insights into the nature of the mind or the nature of yourself. And these actually insights which come after the retreat can be some of the most fascinating. If you investigate, you'll find that that insight had its origin in the meditations you were doing here. Without those meditations, you would never have got that insight, even though there's a long time delay for you getting those insights. And this is the way this mind happens. It's as if that something you've heard or something you've looked at during the meditation retreat has gone into the mind and it's been working and working and working, getting processed, coming to fruition. And just like the flowers under the ground, you can't see all this happening until it suddenly pops up in your daily life. You say, ah, that's what that means. Now I understand. And insights are like that, which occur after a retreat. So be warned, or pleasantly warned, that you're likely to get some really nice insights later on, usually when you least expect them. I say least expect them because sometimes people want to become enlightened very quickly, they want to be wise very quickly, and they try and force these insights, but you just can't do it. I did give earlier the story of that nun who got so frustrated after 7 years of intense meditation, just going to the forest and trying to hang herself, and just at the last moment her mind became freed. There's also the very famous story of Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, who was a stream enterer very early on, but then devoted his certainly his last 25 years just to looking after the Lord Buddha and not really having much time to develop meditation. And the Buddha telling him that maybe, well, when I die, then you become fully enlightened. But even though that's recorded that the Buddha said that, obviously Venerable Ananda sort of didn't take it as 100% certainty, because it was him who, when the Buddha said he was going to die, said, well, it's too early that he dies. The teacher has gone too early and I'm not enlightened yet. If I can't get enlightened when the Buddha's around, how can I get enlightened when he's passed away? And he thought he'd blown his chance for enlightenment. Anyway, after the Buddha died, there was a big convocation, of a meeting of 500 monks. And of those 500 monks, they invited Venerable Ananda. And of those 500 monks, 499 were arahats. And Ananda was the only one who was different. He was just a stream enterer. And the peer pressure was immense. So he decided that he's going to stay all night. He said, you know, you're on this retreat here, and I say that there's, I don't know, 30 on the retreat, say 29 of you got fully enlightened. It's only you, the one who has it. And they think, oh, this is not good enough. And he put forth extra effort. And this is exactly what Venerable Ananda did. He meditated all night. And according to the story, and it's a very powerful story, he meditated all night with no result at all, just mere frustration. But afterwards, at the end of the night, when the dawn came up and he was as far from enlightenment, he thought, as he was at the beginning, he gave up. The meeting was in a couple of hours or so, so he decided just to take a rest. And he lay down, and just before his head hit the pillow, he became completely, fully enlightened. Just when he'd let go and given up, that's when he became fully enlightened. Now many of you have been trying that method of meditation of putting your head on the pillow many times. But it doesn't always work, does it? It's interesting to see what's going on there. And the simile which I give about this is the donkey and the carrot. And it's one of my favourite similes, because you know how they used to in the old days to get donkeys to move along the path? Because donkeys, they won't go just because you tell them. They certainly won't go if you push them or pull them. Donkeys are incredibly stubborn, just like you. And so what you have to do with donkeys, you put a little carrot in front of them on the end of a stick, and the carrot is dangling down on a string, And of course, donkeys like carrots, and so the donkey moves towards the carrot. But of course, the more it moves, the more the carrot moves. Does this bring any similes with your meditation? I said, jhana is this beautiful carrot. You know, and I've been really sort of describing the deliciousness of this carrot, and how sweet it is, and how blissful it is, and how wonderful it is. And every time you move towards it, it seems it sort of goes further away from you. If not jhana, it's enlightenment. This wonderful carrot which you've heard about for so often, and other people say they've tasted it, and it's delicious, it's wonderful. And how can I get some? How can I become enlightened too? And every time you move towards it, it seems it goes further away from you. Now, the wise donkeys, the ones who've got a sort of some brains in them, some IQ, what they do to catch the carrot, you know, after trying to move, and it always moves away from them, they just run like hell after that carrot. They gallop as fast as they possibly can. This is a meditation. You put forth all your effort, sit many hours, really try to get enlightened. The donkey doesn't worry that he's not catching the carrot yet, because he knows this is only the preparation. He doesn't expect to catch the carrot by running. He knows this is one of the important causes. The donkey runs really hard, just like you meditate, you know, very much, but you don't expect results yet. So when the donkey is going at top speed, he digs in his heels very quickly and stops. When you've been meditating really hard, you let go. What happens with a carrot? As soon as you let go, as soon as the donkey stops, the carrot goes even further away. But not for long. Because the carrot goes further away, twice as far as it was before. And then it stops. And all by itself, the carrot starts to swing back. It swings back so far, it goes right in the donkey's mouth. And he's got the carrot, enlightenment. There's a lovely little story there about effort and non-effort. In the case of Venerable Ananda, if he hadn't spent all night meditating hard, then when he stopped, the carrot would have not come towards him. Letting go is an important cause of gaining that carrot, getting enlightened. But it depends upon the effort which you put into meditation beforehand. That's why I kept on saying during this meditation retreat, there is no such thing as a bad meditation. You're building up speed. You're building up the momentum. And even though that carrot seems to be as far away as ever, you're building up momentum, you're building up momentum. The donkey's going faster. And you try stopping. You're letting go. And whenever you let go, it's as if the carrot goes further away. But just wait for a little while. Don't get frustrated, because all of that which you've built up in these so-called frustrating meditations, disappointing meditations, when the carrot hasn't come near you at all that momentum then does its work. And you get the payoff. The Ananda lays down, and the carrot just comes right into his mouth. The nun gives up completely as she's about to jump off with a noose around her head. And because of all those 7 years of what she thought was bad meditation, it was actually good meditation. It was building up steam for the final moment. And then she became fully released. And this is actually how this insight actually works. It's quite fascinating to actually to see that you work so hard, you don't seem to get anywhere. If you don't do any work at all, you don't get anywhere. If you work really hard and then let go, then something's happened. So at the end of this retreat, it hasn't finished yet. You still need a bit more speed on the old donkey over there. But afterwards, when you go back home, this is what happens. Sometimes, because you stop, because you let go, then insights occur. It's a fascinating way. But of course, those insights don't happen if you haven't picked up speed, if you haven't started running, if you haven't really developed at least some power in your meditation. And I think, at least hopefully, that you've all experienced at least something of the power of meditation, something of the depth of peacefulness which you can get to in meditation. Hopefully you've got a little bit further than you had last time. Even though that I teach jhanas in these retreats, it's not so important. I only say this at the end of the retreat, not the beginning. It's not so important if you achieve them in this retreat or not. The very fact that I set such a high goal will always mean you'll try harder and go further. If I didn't give such a high goal, then I wouldn't be encouraging that sort of desire in each one of you to gain these things. If I said, just meditate and just see what happens. If I said, no, don't need to get jhanas. Just wherever you are is okay. You will not be trying so hard. You'll not be sitting so long. You'll not be developing your mind so much. And hopefully you can see the importance of a goal. The importance of a goal is not always to achieve that goal. The importance of the goal is to push you further than you would have gone otherwise. Sometimes it's not the goal which is the important part, it's the journey. Sometimes people used to say to like mountaineers, why did you climb that mountain? It wasn't to get to the top. It was the journey was the important part. It was the climbing up which was the important part, not actually the point where they reached the top. That was just the end of the journey. Even though as a goal, the real goal was in the climbing. In the same here, that reaching these states, sometimes that we need to set that goal for ourselves, but the real benefit is not, as it were, reaching that goal, but it's the journey, what you're doing on the way, because this is where you get the insights. You know, I've been saying a lot about you cannot split up samatha and vipassana, so the calm and insight. If you go for calm, if that's, you know, your goal in inverted commas, then to attain that summit you have to go on a long journey and encounter many insights. You have to, on the journey you'll learn so much about the mind, but if you didn't aim for those jhanas you wouldn't meet any of those insight experiences, and you would never sort of discover some of these finer defilements and obstructions in the mind. And these ways of looking at the mind, one way which leads to obstacles, the other way which leads to going further up towards the jhanas. It is because of these insights you meet on the way that encourage jhanas. So when I teach jhana, it's insight meditation. So even though I've been saying, go for jhanas, it's basically learning about insight. So anyone who teaches jhanas, they're insight meditators. Anyone who teaches insight is jhana meditators. Because whichever one you teach, the other one is being encouraged. But sometimes we talk about insights, and sometimes it's interesting, how do you measure insight? How do you know when insight has happened? How do you know that you know? And so often it's very easy, and you probably know many people who think they know, but they certainly don't. It's so easy for that knowledge or insight to be illusory and to mislead people. Be many people in the history or in my experience as a monk in Thailand who thought they were enlightened, but certainly were not. People who went about saying they were enlightened and were being actually quite stupid and quite misled by that experience. And so sometimes the insight is very hard to know whether it's correct or not. However, there is a way to know whether insight is true and according to the Dhamma, and it's if insight develops peace. That's how you know if insight is true or not. You can't measure your insight by whether you can write this best-selling book on Buddhism, or whether you can give sort of great Dharma talks all over the place. That's not a measure of your insight. The measure of your insight is your ability to be peaceful, to be calm, to be still. just to sit in deep stillness when you meditate, to be peaceful no matter what happens to you in your life, to keep that equilibrium and equanimity. You know it's insight if it leads to peace, to stillness. That's the way you measure insight, by how much peace it gives you. If you want to know how to measure peacefulness, what great stillness is, you measure stillness by how much insight it generates. When you're still, you see further. Once I remember, in Thailand, when I was maybe about 4 or 5 years, Ajahn Chah used to come to our monastery. The monastery where the Western monks used to hang out was only maybe about 5 or 6 kilometers, you know, across the paddy fields, from Ajahn Chah's monastery, and you know, maybe 10 minutes by car along the roads, which went a roundabout way. But Ajahn Chah at this time was starting to get sick, and one of the monks suggested, and it was a brilliant suggestion, a great idea, let's build a sauna at our monastery. For us, obviously, so that the Western monks could sweat out some of the toxins and become more healthy, especially for Ajahn Chah, so that we can invite him every week. And part of the benefit was not just to give Ajahn Chah an opportunity for better health, because we know if Ajahn Chah came to our monastery once a week, not only would have a sauna, but he'd also give us a Dhamma talk, and we'd have him around for a while. So it was an excellent idea to get Ajahn Chah from his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, to our monastery one afternoon a week. And it was a great idea which worked tremendously well. Ajahn Chah would come over one afternoon a week, and he'd come and see all the Westerners and give them a nice Dhamma talk, answer any questions, then go and have his sauna. And we'd be around him all the time. And it's lovely to have him around. So one time when he came for his sauna in the afternoon, we always take turns in helping him, and after the talk, and when he went off to his sauna, there were so many other people helping him, and there's a few Thai lay people went off with him as well. And so I thought, okay, I won't help him this time, I'll just go and behind the hall and just have a nice meditate, because I was inspired by the talk and by his presence. So I sat behind the hall at Wat Nana Chat in Thailand for about 45 minutes or an hour, and a very beautiful meditation. And when I came out afterwards, and very happy and smiling, I thought, oh, I'll go and see if I can help Ajahn Chah now. You never know, I might be able to do something. And so I was walking to the sauna, and I was too late to help Ajahn Chah because he was walking the other way. He was walking back again. And we had like 2 or 3 Thai lay people with him, and talking to them about some Dhamma or whatever. And when he saw me coming in the opposite direction, he obviously realized I'd had a very good meditation, and very sort of deep and very peaceful, because he tried to enlighten me. He looked at me in a way that only one of these very powerful Thai forest Ajahns could, just right boring right in your eyes. And he said, Brahma Wangsa Tammai. Which there's one person who understands Thai here, a couple of monks as well. But what it meant was, Bama Wangso, why? And being only a young monk and quite stupid, I said, I don't know. You're the teacher, tell me. And Ajahn Chah was quite disappointed. But he laughed these things off, as he usually does. And he told me, he said afterwards, he says, if anyone ever asks you that again, the answer is, and to the question why, is my me arai. That's the answer to the question why. My me arai means there isn't anything. He said, do you understand? And I said, sort of. And he says, no, you don't. And he set me off. But it's one of those like teachings which, again, because Ajahn Chah said it, and because it was in that sort of circumstance, it's one of those teachings which was obviously one of the things I had to keep on board for a long time and really work with. Yeah. Why? Answer, there is nothing. And that's Ajahn Chah's beautiful teaching of like emptiness. of non-self. Now why? The answer to that question is nothing. You know that sometimes when you're a kid you ask a question of your mum, you know, why is dinner like this? Because I cook it. Why do you cook it like that? Because that's the way I've learned it. Why did you learn it that way? Because that's what my mother did. Why did your mother do it that way? Because her mother did it. Why did she do that? Because God did it. Why did God do it that way? Why? And that question ends. Why? There's nothing. Just see that great nothingness soaks up all the questions. And just there's nothing left. Nothing embraces everything, envelops it, eats it all up, and makes it nothing. The great emptiness, the great peace. But he will just give me an indication of like where to look in this meditation. And of course, just making that little statement there was like giving that little instruction, which would go in your mind, and would take years before the seed actually develops into a plant and then finally blossoms forth into a flower of true insight. But you can see just how he taught there, giving that little instruction so I'd really remember it and contemplate it, and eventually one will see the answer to this. This is how like the insight works. So when I was saying that all of the meditation which you do here, the seeds in the ground, all these little talks of non-self or our willpower not being yours, these are things which if you say, yeah, I understand it, I will say, no you don't. Just like Ajahn Chah told me, then you have to just wait for a while, and you know that some of these teachings, the ones which really affect you, are the important ones. Those are the ones which are really uncovering a little bit of difficulty, problem, delusion in the mind. But just leave it there and wait and wait and wait, and then a time will come when that teaching becomes very manifest to you. And why a great master, a great monk, a great meditation teacher like Ajahn Chah, why he would answer in that way? Because whatever Ajahn Chah said, you didn't take lightly. He said that, that was deep, that was meaningful. The question, why? There is nothing. So this is the way that actually a lot of the deep insights happen. They happen when you're running after the carrot and then suddenly you let go. Carrot goes away, then it comes back after you again, and then you can eat it. The carrot comes to you, insight comes to you, wisdom comes, rather than you chasing after it. Which is like an interesting experience, and it gives you a little bit of confidence and faith that this path actually does have these marvellous results, and this is how you achieve those results. And indeed, that confidence and faith in the path, as I mentioned in one of those talks about the five spiritual faculties and four powers to success, that confidence again is so important. And one of the reasons again why we give a retreat like this is to increase your confidence in the path. And some of you see samadhi limiters. If I didn't point them out, if we didn't encourage people to get to jhanas, those samadhi limiters may come up, but you'd be completely discard them, think they're irrelevant, and not really pay any attention to them at all. But they are very, very relevant to the teaching of the Buddha. First of all, they're relevant because you find that you can actually see those. Maybe not every meditation, maybe only once a retreat, maybe only once a lifetime. That's enough to get you going anyway. To see there's something more to life than just this external play of material things. To see there's something very deep and wonderful. And it's, again, not as just a intellectual idea, not just something you just have to believe, but something you experience for yourself. You're touching something quite wonderful. Because every time anyone experiences a samadhi nimitta, a good one, it's usually very blissful, very powerful, very awesome. And when you actually see this, you know, you get some idea of where meditation is leading. You may not be able to sustain it, you may not be able to get it back again. But it's fascinating, isn't it, to actually to find where meditation goes. And one experience is worth thousands of talks. Just to be able to see it for yourself, and it gives you a whole sort of mine of insight and understanding of what we mean by the bliss states, what we mean by release, what we mean by the Buddha statement that Nibbana is the highest happiness. What do you mean Nibbana is the highest happiness when Nibbana is cessation, everything's gone? That's why sometimes when they hear about non-self and they hear the goal, Nibbana, is where everything goes, poof, all gone. Thank you very much, goodbye. Think, what's the point of that? Why do you do that? Because it's the highest happiness, that's why. Don't you want the very best for yourself? Don't you want the highest happiness? Don't when you find one bliss which is more delightful than the old bliss, don't you throw away the old bliss and go for the new bliss? Isn't that the nature of human beings? This is a carrot which is always leading you on, bliss. And this is when the Buddha said Nibbana is the highest happiness, cessation. When like a experience in meditation comes up like a nimitta, you see, that's maybe the highest happiness you've ever got a whiff of. Sometimes it's only a sniff and then it disappears again. But the very fact that's a very beautiful high happiness should always encourage you to ask why. You see that the samadhi nimitta, the beautiful things which can arise in the mind, they happen because of all that's ceased, all that's disappeared, all that's gone. It's fascinating to understand that the happiness comes from cessation. The bliss comes from letting go, from abandoning. It's as if that everything we take up in the world, everything we build, everything we do, is just creating a barrier between us and bliss. If you can see that, you can just see how stupid sort of beings are in this world. If they can just let go and do little, then there's more happiness for them. You can see in our Western world that how we go in the opposite direction. Accumulate more, do more, achieve more, get more, possess more. And they're supposed to be the beautiful people in the world, the happy people in the world, according to Time magazine anyway. They're the ones who have the most, who've done the most, who've achieved the most, and they've got the most psychotherapist looking after them. So sometimes you really wonder, is that the highest happiness? And if you can actually get into a samadhi state, or at least have a look at the samadhi nimitta and get at least that insight, you start to understand that simplicity, there is the happiness. And being able to have a house with few possessions, which is so easy to clean, you don't have to look after so much. You don't have to be afraid of burglars coming in. In fact, sometimes if a burglar comes in and sees your empty house, he might have compassion on you and leave a few dollars for you. But isn't it wonderful? There was that story of this king who had great power and great wealth, had everything you could ever want, because in the ancient India, it was the kings who were the beautiful people. They had power, they had wives, they had wealth, they had the best food and the best castles or palaces. One day this king was coming back to his palace and he passed two mango trees. And one of these mango trees was full of beautiful, delicious mangoes. And the other one had no mangoes on it at all. And he looked at the one with no mangoes on it at all and just said, what a terrible tree that was. How useless it was. What purpose does it have in the world? Just a tree, a mango tree without mangoes. And looked at the other mango trees. Then that's what you call a mango tree. So look at all those beautiful mangoes. Look how much it's got. That's the tree I really praise and admire. And he said, right, when I get back to the palace, I'm going to get changed and come back and enjoy some of these mangoes. And so he went back to his palace and got changed. And when he came back again, he found there was no mangoes left on that tree at all. all the soldiers coming behind him. They didn't wait to get changed. And they climbed out of the tree, they threw sticks up there, they broke off the branches, the twigs, the leaves. And that mango tree, which once had all those beautiful mangoes, was so destroyed, so unbroken. And it not just, they didn't take the mangoes. To get the mangoes, they had to take all the leaves, and not all the leaves, but many of the leaves and twigs and branches. It was vandalized. And he looked at that poor old mango tree, which was vandalized, in a really sorry state. And he looked at the other mango tree, which had no mangoes on at all before. And that still had all its leaves and branches intact, healthy, fine, a very beautiful tree. And he got the simile there, the understanding. If you have lots, it's a great burden, and it's also liable to lead to your injury and ill health. You're going to become just like that mango tree which had once many mangoes, and now it's all broken and ruined. But if you have very little, and nothing much affects you in this world, no one climbs up into the tree of the mango tree without any mangoes. And when he actually saw that, he thought, now as a king, as a wealthy person, as a beautiful person in the world, I have so much which other people want. I am just like a tree with all these mangoes on it. And he said, sooner or later somebody's going to come and want those mangoes. So he said, it's much better if I just change into a mango tree without any mangoes at all. When I don't have anything, when I have like hardly any possessions at all, just a few leaves and twigs, but no delicious fruit. And so he gave up the throne and became a hermit, became a peaceful monk. One of the other kings in the time of the Buddha, Abhadra, when he became a monk, and once the other monks found him sitting under a tree, he's going, Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang. Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss. And the monk said, you're thinking about the time you were king, weren't you, when you had all that pleasure? He said, no way. I'm thinking, oh, what bliss, I'm not a king anymore. I can just sit under a tree and meditate. I don't have to do all this work. I don't have to worry about all these armies of my competitors that are trying to sort of come into the kingdom and take the throne. I don't have to have guards posted around me. I don't have to worry whether my wives like me or not. I don't have to worry about whether the government's pinching all my money. I have no worries in the world. I can just sit under a tree and meditate. Aho Sukhang, Aho Sukhang. Oh, what bliss, oh, what bliss. And see how having little is a way to be blissful. Now, of course, in this world, even that king had to have his robes and his bowl and a few other possessions. But the point is that you learn when you meditate to have very little. At least when you meditate, you haven't got a house and a car. You haven't got a mortgage, money in the bank and things or places to go. At least when you meditate, you can be like a tree without any mangoes. By letting go of the past and letting go of the future, you can let go of a lot of possessions. Because actually what is like possessions anyway? It's only when there's a possessor in there will they become possessions. All of these things which you have, always regard them as not yours. They belong to nature. Nature is the owner. Whatever you have, you're just renting. You're borrowing. Whatever you have is only borrowed. And never ever sort of get into the illusion that you own these things. Even though you paid hard cash for your car, you've only borrowed it. Even though that you paid off your mortgage, you've got this house, you've only borrowed that house. The bushfire comes, it's gone. Who's taken it? Nature's taken it. Never think that you own your body. It belongs to nature. After a while, nature will take it. Even now, nature might be playing with it, with sickness and disease and old age. It's nature playing with its own. So all of these things, when you realize that you don't own anything, that's a way to get rid of possessions. You don't need just to give away your house and give away your car and give away your clothes and give away your body, even though you're not dead yet. Does anyone need an organ? Come and take it. Does anyone need a leg? You can have it here, I'll get by on one. The way to give things away is to realize there's no possessor there, no owner there.